All right, Gina.
Mm-hmm.
We've already started, so.
Oh, fabulous.
All right.
Well, thank you, Christopher, for getting me the footrest, and I'm feeling very welcomed.
Very welcome. All right, Gina. Mm-hmm. Welcome to another episode of the CG Garage.
Thank you for having me.
What episode number are we, Gina?
We are 63, Christopher.
Yes, we are. Mm-hmm. And we are going to be doing, actually, we just finished recording this podcast, which is going to be featured on coming out.
On 64?
No, we're just doing 63. We decided we're going to do it this week. So I'm going to do Eric Barba this week.
Oh, got it. Oh, you did a bait and switch on me.
I did.
Typical man. That's all right. I'm used to it. Yeah. I can do this. I can work on the fly.
I talked about it with Lon a little bit, and he said, you know, that'd be good because you just did one with Flato. And so instead of doing another really technical one, we could do one that was really kind of interesting with Eric. So Eric Barba was
not
just here.
Not the technicals. Ooh, wow. Slurring my words. Guys, I may or may not have dipped into the punch at lunch.
Yep.
I'm just telling the truth.
That's right. Margaritas were a little stronger than usual.
They were, because they took so darn long.
Oh, so they felt bad, so they gave you a finger.
So all of a sudden, took a big swig and wow.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Tequila. Right. Sorry, go on.
That's all right. So Eric is, you know, I've talked about Eric a lot.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, he's a huge mentor of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really, really excited. Mm-hmm. Excited and sad. Excited because Eric is going on some new adventures that he's just going. He's going to be the creative director at Industrial Light and Magic in Vancouver.
And he was previously at DD.
Yeah, for years, almost 20 years.
Wow. Longer than I've been alive. I love that Parker's laughing.
So yes, he's been around for a long time. He is probably one of my biggest mentors in visual effects. And he, you know, I first worked with him on Tron. Actually, Stephen Parker and I both did it on Tron, and Parker is on this podcast as well. So we talked about Tron and a bunch of things. He has won his Oscar. We had the other person at Digital Domain who won an Oscar.
Eric, not Parker.
Eric, yes. Eric won his Oscar on Benjamin Buttons. And Steve Prieg, who we had one of the first podcasts with, was also an Oscar winner on Benjamin Buttons. So we talk about digital doubles and how that came about. We talk about his very strong relationships with David Fincher and Joe Kaczynski and how that was gone about. And that was a lot of good discussions on that. What else did we talk about, Stephen? We just finished recording. We talked about just general filmmaking, what life was like at a Digital Domain, what's going on over at ILM. And
do you tell some really old stories about DD?
We do tell some old stories about DD. Yeah, we did.
The good times, the bad times, the middle of the road times.
Yeah.
Because I really like the old times, because those, like the, you know, the frat boy times were the fun kind of. Those stories were good stories.
He doesn't really. Eric wasn't really one of the part of the frat boys guys there. He was he's a hustler, yeah.
Mm.
And he really taught me how to get an eye on things, like how to see things correctly. So he was very good at teaching me those skills, which I really appreciate, and also working with people and how to get the best out of people, including how to get best out of myself.
Very good.
Yeah.
So maybe I should have a talk with them. Because I need to sometimes.
Yeah. But he's cool, and I'm really sad because he's going to be in Vancouver. But the next time we go to Vancouver, we'll go hang out and check out where he's doing. And if he comes down here, we'll hang out again. So that'll be fun.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Okay, Eric. So let's start a little bit with the fact that all three of us sort of got together for the first time to work at all was on Tron.
Yep.
That was a big one.
That was a fun one.
Yeah. And so that was the big film. That was actually my return to DD. I probably would not have gone back to DD if it wasn't for that. I think that was something that was very interesting. I never worked with you before, because before you were, when I was there the first time, you were mostly, you were doing all the commercial work mostly, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was in commercials for quite a long time. I got lucky in that I got an opportunity to work with Fincher.
Right.
And then, you know, he was like going to master's in film school. I just, every time he had a project, I just had to work on it, and we worked together for quite a while.
Right.
So it was a great, well, it was an amazing learning experience up until Zodiac and then Button.
So Zodiac was one of your first films you did, right?
As a supervisor.
As a supervisor, yeah.
When I first got to DD, I was put on a little bit of Titanic doing some R&D for the digital boat.
Yep.
And then quickly on to Fifth Element, helping design the shader for the cars, because at that point they were using RenderMan, and you know, everything had to be written into a shader. And
right.
I had done a test where Mark Stetson, who was the visual effects supervisor, ironically, we both went to Art Center.
Yeah.
And so we kind of hit it off, and you know, they would hand me some sketches and I would build them real quick. And after I built the car, I'm like, well, you know, I could render this thing out. And I'd render out some tests, and he just loved what I was doing. And so he pulled me into helping them develop the look and
the
stuff.
The car stuff.
For Fifth Element.
Yeah, because there was a lot. Obviously, there was a lot of cars. It was a big cityscape with these weird cars in there, right?
Yeah. It was at that point, it was so much fun because, you know, Mark has a very I learned so much from him. He was one of my early mentors, and uh-huh. He had a miniature model background. And so I learned a ton of stuff from Mark.
Right.
Just being in dailies and hearing what he was calling out, seeing the motion control miniature dailies and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's what I took away when I was, you know, decided at some point that I really was interested in being a supervisor or whatever, is to listen to what's being called out and seeing what because you can actually learn to have a good eye. In some cases,
you can't. I call it learning by osmosis.
Right.
It's why on if you remember on Tron, you know, I kind of mandated that all the artists had to be in dailies.
Right.
Because that's your opportunity to get there as a team and to see everything together, and you know, hear what so and so likes, see what they don't like, and you know, I don't have any problems with someone else putting their hand up. Hey, I think that's too blue. And sometimes, you know, it's really great to have someone else's opinion. And
right.
Mark ran his dailies that way, and so I kind of patterned mine after him.
Yeah, I think it's a really good thing, and just sort of listening and understanding, because the thing is, you know, Tron was the first show I worked with you on, and I knew it was like, okay, this guy's tough. This guy's really tough. You didn't, there's nothing would slide by. Nothing would be like, yeah, it's good enough. There's nothing good enough in the Eric Barba situation, yeah. Which was fine, because that what I learned through that process, like, and I've worked on many shows with you since then, is that that's not going to pass by Eric. So, and therefore, I'm not going to let that happen. And not that I should either. So I learned a lot from understanding what you would want, you know?
Well, I mean, I've always felt visual effects is a team sport, right? And mm-hmm. So everyone has to play their role. And my role is to hopefully guide and kind of be a coach, if you use the metaphor of a sports team. And, you know, someone has to set the bar, and you know, if everyone knows what the expectations are, I think it makes it easier in some ways, because you're not guessing, and everyone knows that, look, they gotta be on their game.
Right. So you did Zodiac, obviously that was your first supervisor role in a feature film. And then obviously it was Buttons right after that, right?
Yep. Benjamin Button. That was a passion project of uh-huh. David's. And, you know, we had,
cause I remember some of the early tests on that were done during, I was on Stealth, and they were doing some early tests on that. So that's
We did it, the first test in 2004. So
right.
I met David. Actually, I bid a job with David probably in 2001, and it didn't go. It was one of the BMW film jobs that he was going to direct, and he ended up not doing.
Oh, cool.
And then about a year later, the DS Mechanical Leg spot came in with David.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the opportunity to work with him, and you know, it's like, now's my chance. We gotta hit it out of the park with this one.
Mm-hmm.
And he, again, I learned so much from him with what he was calling out. And
but David has a VFX background, right?
Yeah, well, he started, you know, early days as a kind of camera operator at Industrial Light and Magic,
right.
Helping out there, and I'm sure, you know, being around all that. And you know, he's the smartest guy in the room. He can do everyone's job, and you
right.
know, you just have to explain one new thing to him, and he, in the same sentence, he's turning it around, explaining to you how you could use it doing something you didn't think about yet. And you're like, oh, right. Oh yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was we're working with him on that first project, you know, he told me, well, this is what I'm going to do, you're going to do, and you're going to do all the CG. I'm like, oh, okay.
Okay.
Going, holy shit, how are we going to do all that?
Right.
But, you know, he has such a vision, he makes it easy. And then, you know, we run back to DJ and going, okay, guys, we got to get our crap together because it's going to be great. But he's got some high expectations and it's not going to be easy. But
well, again, I think that's the exact same mentality that I had when I started working with you, in the same sense as like, oh, crap, I got to figure this stuff out, you know. And so you probably had a very similar experience with David, right?
Absolutely. He became my mentor and pushing me. And, you know, at that point, I'd done a lot of commercials, supervising commercials for other directors and this, that, and the other thing. And what I quickly found with David is with some directors, you go in and say, hey, you should really shoot this. And no, we're going to do that CG. And we're going to shoot this. And I'll get an element here, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, okay, great. Where David would come to me and say, you're going to do this in CG. I'm going to shoot that. And you're going to do this in CG. And I'm like, what? No, can't we shoot that?
Yeah.
And so, you know, he's always pushing, and he'd explain why he didn't want to shoot too many, it's taking too long to do too many setups, we don't have time to do this, blah, blah, blah. And you go, oh, right, that makes sense. So
He's already had it all figured out.
Got it all figured out. So he's constantly pushing. And for David, doing commercials, and he said this, and music videos, that's fun for him. That was his playtime. That was his ability to test new people out, R&D, try new cameras. We started shooting digitally with some of the spots we did.
Yep.
So he was just constantly wanting to experiment and try new things. And the Benjamin Button project was definitely a passion project. He'd give me the script, I want to say probably early 2004 or late 2003, somewhere in there. And I read it and I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. Of course, we have to do this together. And then for me, it was just, that was my drive. I have to do this project with David.
Right.
So as we would do projects together, he'd say, hey, so for Button, we're going to do this and we'll try that. And then we do another project and say, so what I'm thinking, I'm thinking we'd do this and we'll shoot with this camera. And so everything we were doing was kind of leading up to that. And then in 2004, we did the first test.
Right.
And I remember knowing what we had to do, and there was a little tug of war back then with features commercials, and the feature side kind of pulled me in, and they said, well, you're going to sit down and bid it out with our feature guys, and they're going to kind of show you how it's done. I'm like, oh, okay. And so I listened to what they had, and they put this budget together, and then the budget came back, and I want to say it was like $1.2 million to do this test that David wanted to do.
Right.
And when David heard the number, of course, he just flipped out. And he called me up. He was like, you're going to do it and he gave me a number, and you're going to make it work. And I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. And then I went back and I said, a lot of what the feature side was doing is a very, I don't want to say old, but it was a model based on doing, you know, a large show to put out lots of shots. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the commercial plan, which is you get a really bunch of talented super people and you make something.
Squeeze it down.
And for a test, really, that's what you're doing. You're just kind of making something. But the powers that be at the time felt that, you know, we had to have a plan going into the film. And my whole thing was like, well, I can make this thing great and let's get the film greenlit and that'll teach us what we need to know to build for the movie. And so we did it for a tenth of the cost of that original number. And the test went great. The only thing the test didn't have is there wasn't a speaking part of it.
Right.
But that had been kind of called out ahead of time because of costs and who's going to play the role.
Had you figured out who the actor was at that point or not yet?
David knew, but
he didn't tell you.
Well,
or he may have told you.
No, he knew, but it wasn't. What if Brad hadn't been available?
Right.
What if the timing wasn't right? So you don't want to bake it in right off the bat. And at least that was my take on it. So we put a little plan together with my small little commercial team, and we finished it. It went over really well. I remember sitting in the meeting with Sherry Lansing. I remember Frank Marshall, the first time we showed it to him, he literally looked at it and then looked at me and said, I haven't seen anything that impressive since I saw the first dinosaur walk for Jurassic Park.
I got to say, I remember seeing it, you know, when I was on stealth and I was like, oh my God, it was amazing. And this, you guys sort of found a way to make it work. It wasn't, you weren't, hadn't developed a big pipeline now. You just want to say,
it was crafted. It was
yes,
finely crafted.
Yeah.
But it did the job. And it
showed what its potential could be.
Yeah.
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 It was really, really quite incredible. And I hadn't seen anything like that, which obviously was one of the big reasons you guys had worked on Buttons after that. But you had then Buttons was kind of an interesting thing because that was like a bigger show for DD. Now that was like after Zodiac, that was bigger for you guys.
Well, right? it was unheard of, right? So and there were politics then. So after the test in 2004, mm-hmm. You know, we thought the movie was going to go then, and you know, it was bid out the quote unquote feature way. And, you know, there was talk behind the scenes of essentially like, well, Eric's never done a feature film, so this is all DD, you know, management. So what we're going to do is we're going to put so-and-so on it, and then Eric will just kind of be the liaison, and we'll just take him off and we'll put someone else on it. And it was really, you know, Ed and David basically said, look, I'm only coming here to work with Eric and his team, so mm-hmm. if I don't get Eric, why would I even come here?
Right.
Which, you know, there was politics between the commercial and the feature divisions back yep. then. So they felt like, well, this is a feature. We should do it. And David wanted me, and he, and so, you know, we did it. We didn't do it then. You know, there was a deal where, you know, essentially they came back and said, look, we'd love to do this movie, but, you know, we really want to do Zodiac with you, and then we'll do Button. So David said, okay, great. We'll go off and do Zodiac. And it was a great script.
Right.
It was a really great script. And so we did Zodiac, and then right on the heels of Zodiac did Button.
Well, what was interesting about that movie is the fact that, you know, that was the first time that you guys were going to tackle the hardest thing in CG, which is the Uncanny Valley, right?
Yep.
And you guys, it's still, to my mind, stands as the benchmark of like, that's when it happened.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, we're certainly proud of it. It was a great team we assembled.
Of course.
It wasn't easy.
But again, I think a lot of it, you guys went over it, and then you guys like dumped 60% of the shots and did them over again because you weren't happy.
Well, it wasn't 60. We actually only turned around 80 shots, and it was like little things we adjusted. But it was the time to do it and to finesse that, to me, makes all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. And ironically, I learned so much from that experience where, you know, when certainly, Photoreal Head at the time was the holy grail of visual effects, which mm-hmm. you know, made me excited to do it and got me out of bed every morning. But when you see the shots in dailies, you know, you'd see them and go, "Ah, looks pretty good." And sometimes I'd just kind of cringe and go, "I need to show this to David, because especially with the small little performance things, I want to make sure that he's getting what he wants." Mm-hmm. It's easy to say, "Look, does the hair look real? The matte looks good? Does the skin feel great? Is it the kind of soft light that matches what Claudio shot?" Mm-hmm. We get things in front of David, and those first shots, you know, they look great. He's like, "Oh, this looks great. This looks great." And it's normal to start putting them in a cut and start, "Wow, this looks really good." But by the time you get to shot 300, mm-hmm. the team is much better at what they're doing.
Suddenly,
and the way
those
they're
earlier
crafting.
Shots look, yeah.
Yeah, so you go back, and those earlier shots, like, we let that one go. It's like, "Oh, no, the new version of the head does this," and rerun it, and bang, you put it out, and it's instantly better.
Right.
So some of that is just the nature of, you know, doing that many shots with a small dedicated team. You just get better at your job as you go.
Right.
And so because of when we were scheduled to finish the film versus when the film was actually released, we did have a small window. So we kept this tiny little team on, and we went over to David's office, and, you know, we got a bunch of notes, and then mm-hmm. we went back to DD, and we just slowly started making the little adjustments. And so I learned from that experience, and I actually planned with Lisa Baru, my right arm producer, to do the same thing on Tron. Mm-hmm. But there was a company that was working on Tron that, you know, had to handle a bunch of work back because they just couldn't get it done at the last minute. And that ate up my buffer time that we had planned to redo shots, because all of a sudden, all hands on deck just to finish the film.
Yep.
And I'm still angry with that company because they took away that time that would have been so valuable to finesse.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I remember I was traveling trying to figure that out too myself. Yeah. But okay, so let's talk about that, because, you know, obviously we know the outcome of Benjamin Button's a fantastic film. In my mind, still the gold standard in terms of, this is when that happened. This is when we figured out that we actually can cross the valley. There's a proof of that.
Yep.
If anyone has to just, you know, recount it. And this is something that we discuss in my group of guys on the Digital Human League as well. And obviously Steve Prieg has very strong reasons to acknowledge why he's part of that, because he was part of that Benjamin Button's.
He was a crucial part. That, yeah. I had there's probably 10 or 15 people that, you know, without them, we couldn't have gotten there.
Right. So those were really, really cool. And then obviously your relationship with Fincher is still very strong. I worked with you on Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. That was actually a lot of fun. You know, that was a really easy show for us just to like, but it was there to like flexing our muscle and figuring out, like, you remember, like, you know, just, you know, there's a lot of interesting things we did, but there was this, you basically got the smartest guys around to do really cool, fun stuff. So,
but it's easy to get a team galvanized around a Fincher project because, sure, you know, it's going to be great.
Right.
And those, for his movies, what we do is meant to be entirely invisible.
Yep.
And so it really ups your game, and you know, it wasn't hard to recruit. Ironically, when we did Button, mm-hmm, it was incredibly hard to recruit for that film.
Yeah, I heard. Why was that?
Well, you know, Dee Dee was going through some turmoil. When is Dee Dee not going through turmoil? So Dee Dee was going through some turmoil with, it had just been sold. And, you know, we had this team come down from up north, you know, Mark Miller, Kim LeBrary, and Cliff Plumer. And there was just all this going on. There was Mummy 3 that was going on, and there was, right, Speed Racer going on. And of course I had Button that was trying to ramp up. So you had these three shows that were ramping at the same time. And I remember, cause I sat with the managers and certainly Jeff Stringer at the time, and they'd be interviewing people, and it's like, well, we're doing Speed Racer and we're doing the Mummy, and then we're doing this thing with Benjamin Button. We're doing a photo real head, and everyone would go, I want to do a Mummy. I want to go on Speed Racer. Cause it scared them.
Yeah.
But for me, that was the natural filter,
right?
Like, I don't want anyone on this show that isn't as passionate about it, yeah, as I am, because, yep, we'll never get there.
Yep.
So I only want the people that really
want to do this,
yeah, and are as excited about it as I am. Otherwise, you know, I'm gonna, I don't want to have to be pushing people along, and so that was, there was a natural filter, and it introduced us to a lot of really great people that hadn't worked at DD before.
Sure.
And I brought over a core team of people that had worked with me on David Spots from commercials, mm-hmm, much to the chagrin of Ed Elbrook at the time, because, you know, it's like it kind of ripped a core out of there that
right,
commercials never quite
and
recovered.
And Ed was still in commercials at that point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At that point, yeah. But, you know, he was also a very great mentor to me and taught me a hell of a lot. But, mm-hmm, you know, we all knew that, look, this is the holy grail of visual effects, at least that's how we saw it at the time, and we needed to build the best possible team to attack it.
Yeah.
Because you don't get those opportunities very often to have it and then not hit a home run, you know, you kind of never live down.
Sure. So what is the relationship? Because obviously, you know, you have a very strong relationship with David, but you also have a very strong relationship with Joe Kaczynski, right?
Yep.
And so what is the relationship between those two guys? Because I know they know each other, right? We've established part of that.
Oh, yeah. No, they're actually close as well. So Joe, as a young director, you know, met Dave Morrison showing his reels and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Dave Morrison introduced him, at least this is what my understanding, introduced him to David. Mm-hmm. And then in 2005, this all happened about, I think, 2005, Fincher was doing a Nine Inch Nails music video.
Yeah, that was the first thing rendered in V-Ray.
Which we did in V-Ray. Yeah, and that's another story. We were planning and prepping, and he says to me one day when we were planning, it's like, look, I'm going to bring by this young director. I think you'd really like him. You guys would hit it off. He's done this really cool CG piece. I'm like, okay, great, let's bring him by. And so when we were shooting, he introduced me to Joe Kaczynski.
Right.
And, you know, I think Joe and I hit it off immediately, and you know, he's just a really nice, likable guy, and he asked a bunch of questions, and we just immediately, you know, started exchanging things, and then
you were doing a couple car commercials.
Well, at that point, I don't. So the timeline's getting a little fuzzy for me because what happened is I went off and did. Is that after Zodiac? Because we did a Gears of War project together. And originally, Fincher was going to do the Gears of War project.
And then Joe did it instead.
Yeah, and I had gotten the phone call that, David was going to do this project and you're going to do it with them. Great. And then David needed to go off and do location scouting for Button. Mm-hmm. And so David was repped by a company called Anonymous Content in the commercial world at that point.
Okay.
And Joe Kaczynski had signed on with Anonymous Content. And Dave Morrison was an EP there.
Which is, by the way, just around the corner from here. So
yes. Well, they're no longer there.
Oh, really?
Because Dave Morrison started his own company probably in 2014, maybe.
Okay.
Called Reset, which now Fincher, Kaczynski, and Tim Miller are represented in the commercial
that
world.
That is quite a powerhouse.
Yeah, and so I've known Dave since... Sorry. The early days working with David when he was Anonymous Content. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Joe gets into putting on this Gears of War job, and then I did it with him, and I've been doing all of Joe's work as much as I could since.
Right.
When the first teaser came in for Tron, he asked me to do it, and I planned it and bid it out.
Yep.
And then because I was doing button, handed it off to another supervisor, and that team did a great job. But when it was greenlit, he came back to me and says, I want you to do the movie. Mm-hmm. And I was literally finishing up button, directing three spots for Honda with Brad Parker, and then trying to ramp up Tron all at the same time.
And Tron was going to be so after button, very hard show, but we were talking about it at lunch. It's like, it's three assets, right? Yeah. It was a head. So yes. Really had to get very good at this. And you really had to craft that head for every shot.
Well, we actually didn't. I mean, because I came from my commercial background and crafting really great things on a small schedules with a really talented team, mm-hmm. I was really, that's what I knew how to do. And it was really the me bonding with Steve Prieg and, him kind of explaining, a larger scale project and all the things we'd have to build and do. And he, Steve's a really smart guy. He's got a better radio voice than I do. He could explain things to me so that it just made sense.
Sure.
Where I wasn't going, why are we doing that? And so the way he explains it was, I get it. So we kind of bonded and, mm-hmm. and so I supported him and,
yep.
We had to build a pipe that, because there's consistency, right, with a human mm-hmm. that you have to have and the lighting. And I had my ideas on how we needed to replicate the lighting. At that point, DD had only used, Render Man on future films. And mm-hmm. I come from a ray tracing background. And
right.
for me, using anything other than ray tracer, I just didn't understand. Because I'd look at that work and it goes, that doesn't look real to me. It just looks totally bogus.
Well, how do I know where the light's actually bouncing from?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about Fresnel, but it's like you never had that in some of those renders. And I struggled with it even on Fifth Element because they were trying to replicate what I'd rendered in a ray tracer. And it just never felt the right way because
right.
it was all kind of a hack. And I didn't realize how much, you had to hack Render Man to get things looking good,
yep.
which is where the skill was, right? And those, all those great shader writers. But anyway, so we had to build a pipe that worked with ray tracing, we had to figure out a way to recreate Claudio Miranda's lighting directly from set. Mm-hmm. So, cause I had pitched David's like, Claudio needs to light each one of these heads perfectly. And mm-hmm. we're just going to match perfectly because what I don't want to do is get us involved in trying to relight. Cause we're not really good at lighting humans. That's Claudio's craft and your
right,
craft.
Right, exactly.
And David knew what he wanted, so he agreed to do that.
And you already had a person's head there anyway. You had to replace that head. So he could light to something real.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that was certainly a huge help for us on that movie was that the certainly David, the way he composes a shot, the set, everything is beautiful. And Claudio did an amazing job with all the footage that we got. So that keeps the bar high. And we had to figure out a way to... bring all that data back and make something of it. And we mm-hmm. created something that I thought was really cool at the time. I didn't realize how far ahead we were, but it was really cool at the time.
Yeah. And he was the same DP on Tron too, wasn't he?
Yeah. I called Claudio my brother from another mother. We actually go way back to around 2000 when I first started shooting with him. And, we love working with each other because I get him, he gets me. And
yep.
he's always very helpful to the visual effects
sure.
team. Some DPs, let's just say, maybe not as helpful.
Sure.
But he usually, with his crew, goes above and beyond. And he knows that it only makes him look better if our stuff looks seamless. And
right.
so he's always very helpful. And, obviously working with David on a bunch of projects with Claudio and then segueing on to working with Joe Kaczynski on a bunch of projects. Mm-hmm. We just have a great working relationship.
So what was, I remember when Stephen, when you started on Tron, around what time was it? How long had you been there before I got there?
I came down beginning of 2009.
Okay.
I think January.
So it must have been about 6 months before because I came in at the end of.
Yeah, it's because we were using Mental Ray. And I guess I had seen the test that you guys did. In V-Ray, actually, right? So that was one of the things that I had seen and was like, oh, shit. And, I love the property itself. But I came down basically because they were setting up a Mental Ray pipeline, and that's what I was familiar with.
Right.
And then Eric pulled the rug out from under us on it, and it was the best move that we could have done.
Well,
and that's not just because of who I work for now.
So what happened when I was at Method, and then obviously there was hints of like, we're going to do at least – one portion or some part of this going to be done in V-Ray. It was all going to be done Mental Ray, and then the environments was going to be done in V-Ray. And that's when I got a phone call And Greg Teagarden came up to me and says, okay, let's figure out what we can do to get you on, because you obviously know V-Ray for a long time. And it's like, we've got people in commercials that know V-Ray, but they wanted to get another heavy in there. And so I say, okay. And I was like, yes, Tron. Yes. I saw the test, obviously, I was at Comic-Con, et cetera. And I was like, that looks awesome. And I've been doing car commercials for a long time, right? And so I came in and was like, okay, cool. We're going to do environments, back to my architecture roots. It's going to be great. And then was like not even a week that I got there that there was hints that a lot more was going to be done in V-Ray. And a lot of changes were happening. And then you started to say, Chris, can you help people with the light bike sequence? And I was like, oh, no, I'm going back to a car commercial.
That was a pretty fun car commercial.
Oh yeah, it was. It was a pretty fun car commercial.
There was a lot of controversy. I'm sure you guys remember, because what happened was I had up until probably 2005, right?
And you wasn't have a small team at this point. You had a large team working on this.
It was a lot. I was steering, but it goes back to, I started out in this business using Alias, and then quickly got handed an Amiga and Video Toaster to work on Steven Spielberg's movie or a television show called Sequest.
Right.
And so I'd come from knowing what a ray tracer could do on Alias, and then all of a sudden I'm using this ray tracer called Lightwave. And, that team helped build Lightwave into a pretty good production tool, because that's all we were doing in production at that point. Mm-hmm. The programmers would fly out and sit with us, and we'd give them notes. And sometimes he'd sit with me, and I'd Alan Hastings, and I would bring up Alias and say, hey, I can do this thing in Alias. And he'd be writing down on his legal pad pretty quickly, and then we'd get that kind of feature set in Lightwave. But because I was used to a ray tracer up until about, like I said, 2000, well, until we did the Nine Inch Nails music video, I couldn't understand why you do it any other way. We started using HDRs very mm-hmm. early on, and that Mechanical Leg Spot was one of the first ones we did a big shoot for.
Yep.
So I couldn't understand why the features at that time in Digital Main wasn't using a ray tracer. I was just baffled. Mm-hmm. I just didn't see it in the quality of the work. So there's a lot I didn't know, obviously.
It was about scale back then.
Yeah, there's things I just took for granted. I'm just all about the image, and that looks better. And why wouldn't you use that?
Yep.
I didn't even get frustrated when I saw the iRobot stuff, because I'd never felt that looked photoreal. Mm-hmm. It always bugged me, especially after we did the mechanical legs thing. But I know some of those are design choices too. Rob Niederhorst gets credit for showing me the first V-Ray renders.
I get credit for showing Rob.
Though. Okay, fair enough. that I think Andy Wilkoff was testing on Stealth.
Yeah, so there was a, they made a skunk team, I think there was. And there was one, Andy Wilkoff, I believe, was doing it in Lightwave. Then Rob Niederhorst was doing it in V-Ray. And then they did one in Brazil and then one in RenderMan. So they did four different renderers that they were testing it out. And clearly, we know where the winners were going to be.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
The ones that can, get an actual bounce of light to be correct. And they decided it's like, okay, we're going to use the one that did the worst result, but we're going to force that person to figure out how to make it look like the other ones.
I don't understand the logic there. I mean, I didn't understand it back then, but I'm like, whatever. But I just saw it and went, so, Lightwave had its run. Right. And all of a sudden, I got exposed to this new render that could do GI, and it looked really great. And
it was fast.
It was fast. So when we started the Nine Inch Nails music video, we did some tests early on in Lightwave. Mm-hmm. And then I had Rob do a test in Max and V-Ray.
Yep.
And I was blown away with the result.
And that was another struggle, because they had a hard time accepting it. Before, back then, V-Ray was only available on Max, not in Maya, and there was a lot of like, oh, you can never do anything good in Max, and that's like ridiculous.
Oh, it was totally ridiculous. Yeah. And so I took this team of Lightwave artists, and I said, guess what, guys? You're all going to learn Max, right, so we can do this music video. And then I went out and we hired a few Max hotshots, and we put that team together, and we did the Nine Inch Nails.
You did the exact same thing, just scaled up on Tron.
Exactly. So I already had that experience. Yeah. So, we needed to do Mental Ray for Button, because, we brought in these Jonathan Litt, and then we had a few other really amazing shader writers. And what they pulled off for what we needed worked incredibly well. But we started to struggle on Tron with Disk Game. You know, we had a render through refraction, reflection, motion blur.
Motion blur was the problem,
I think. And it just wasn't working. And at the same time, the commercial team, all my old, you know, guys that I kind of brought up were using the first version of V-Ray for Maya, mm-hmm. and had done some pretty cool things with this car chase thing. Mm-hmm. And I was actually shooting Tron, and they sent it to me. And I'm like, holy crap. And I sent it back to my Tron team and said, this looks pretty good. You guys should really investigate using V-Ray on this show. And of course, you know, the mental ray guy's like, well, no, it would never scale. And we need to write these custom shaders. And
that was me.
Do this and do that. And I'm just like, but look. And I'm just thinking speed, because I'm used to speed. And right. If it looks great, it's like car commercials is a lot, like you said, it's a lot like what we're going to do on Tron.
Yeah.
And so, look, I just put
but my. But it head. Was about reflection. I mean, that's the thing, right?
It was risky, though, because it hadn't been. We were on Linux. We couldn't change that fact. It hadn't been in Maya very long. And we had to use it standalone just because of just how we had to get things done.
I'm not saying it wasn't risky.
Oh, no. I mean, but all those, like, scared the shit out of me, though. Well, because I was like, all these things are completely untested. And that's kind of basically how I came to know Lotto. I mean, because that guy just did not sleep. And we were hammering them. Like, we were trying to trip it up. Because we were,
because you wanted it to fail so you could go back.
Not necessarily one way or the other, but like we needed to hammer the shit out of it as quickly as we could to either dismiss it or embrace it.
Well, thank God that, you know, I think you and John didn't dismiss it right off. I know we had some shader writers.
Well, I don't think you guys know this, but
Mental Ray was not a pleasure.
When I just, you know, I got the offer to go to DD on Tron, and then I actually called Vlado. I said, Vlado, I'm about to go to DD, about to work on a huge thing. I kind of explained to him, they're going to hit you hard. And it got even worse. And he goes, okay, I'm ready for it. And so he told me that.
Yeah, we came at him.
Yeah.
But it was, there were so many politics that I had to go through. So not only did I have my own team kind of undermining me, saying, Eric's crazy. We shouldn't do this in V-Ray. Mm-hmm. It won't work, blah, blah, blah. I got called into a meeting with then our CEO, the vice president of the division, our tech people, and basically all telling me why I was wrong and we should stick with Mental Ray. And I kind of looked at all of them going, do you guys even know what you're talking about? And I started explaining why we were having problems. And the guy who remained nameless, that was responsible for kind of the relationship with Mental Ray, was saying, well, we'll have motion blur working in 2 weeks, and we'll have this working. And I'm like, the licensing alone to scale, right, for Mental Ray is going to be so cost prohibitive. And what they're offering us for V-Ray, and I know these guys, I've done projects with V-Ray, mm-hmm. they will help us. So instead of us having to write all this code, they're going to help get us there. It'll scale faster across all of our procs. I'll be able to render more of our CPUs, mm-hmm. and it's going to look better. And they just kind of looked at me like I had two heads, like they'd never heard this before. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, the VP who was my boss looked at me and said, okay. And we had a couple people quit immediately because they were pissed that I was going that direction. But it was the best decision we made at the time, because I don't know how we'd have gotten it done had we not done it.
What was the shot count?
Oh, geez, 1,565, but who's counting?
And mostly CG.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the point. I think that's the thing that scared me.
The only
people.
Thing that stayed in Mental, right, and I think this was also a wise choice, was to keep the head because the head was already so well developed from buttons at this point that was...
But that was the last time it was done in Mental, right?
After that, the next step was like, okay, guys, now we have a little bit of a break. Let's figure out how to move all those shaders over to V-Ray.
Yeah, which that's...
And that's what you know, obviously we've done a bunch of that. But yeah, it was
fun.
So the politics,
when I got... thankfully for everybody.
When I got there,
I'm glad I moved from San Francisco for this. This is awesome.
The politics were really rough when I came. I was like, oh my God, what did I walk into?
Yeah, there's a lot.
And then by the time, you know, the stuff really started rolling and the light bike sequence was looking awesome and the light jet sequence and
disc game,
all of it looked incredible. And the city stuff, I know Kevin Sears was kicking ass on doing a lot of the cityscape stuff. I was just loving it. And
not one person from management ever came back to me and said, Eric, that was the right choice.
Yeah. Really?
Not one.
No one really acknowledged the fact.
Internally, we were all, because
they had to eat their own words.
Yeah.
Well, I had to.
It made some people look bad who'd made a big stink.
Right.
Right.
Well, it was definitely the right choice, and obviously that stayed for a long time. Now, that was a tough, like, yeah, that was a tough choice. But I mean, working with Joe was awesome. Yep. And Joe, again, he's another Fincher. He knows his shit, you know.
He's because he's done his own 3D. He can communicate directly to us with what we're familiar with. Yeah. But he's also a filmmaker, so he can speak in those terms, and he knows what he wants. Yep. He's really polite, very nice, that's what you want. You want a director that knows what he wants and can communicate.
Yeah.
And has a vision.
He was the only one I know who asked me what my noise threshold was on the shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was an awesome guy, and obviously we continued to work with him on Oblivion. Was
yes.
really yeah. cool.
Well, I'm that's working a with huge him now.
Benefit, I mean, oh, you're working with him now, yeah.
Of having somebody that is just familiar with it, like yeah. it just makes the show so much.
Yeah. Well, the decision is not like I don't know,
like it just comes,
make it look better. Like no, he's like okay, you know what
top.
We need.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, he's great, and he's a lot like David. They both know what they want, mm-hmm. which for visual effects artists. And certainly a supervisor makes it easy because instead of spending my energy going, okay, so he'll know it when I see it, so I'll just show him these things. You know, you have a singular drive to get his one vision out there, so you spend all your energy and effort making that one thing great
yep.
versus dividing it, and then hopefully you get something that's okay. And both of them are also been very great with me, and they're allowing me to give my artistic, you know, two cents and show yeah. them things that I think look good. And
well, you've developed enough and long enough relationship with them. I mean, I've worked... Actually, I did a Halo spot with you too, and then I did Oblivion with you. So that's three Joe spots I did with the two of you. And I like by the end, it's like, yeah, it's like you guys are just talking like, you know, like a couple. Yeah. That was exactly yeah. what they want. And so that was really, really, really cool because you know what? I'll tell you this honestly, and you probably know exactly what I'm talking about. When we were on Tron, you and I used to fight a lot on Tron, creatively speaking, right? I would be like, nope.
I never saw it as fighting because I was just telling you what I wanted.
Chris just takes shit too personally.
Yeah.
But you did, and you were basically, and then the next show, it's like, I don't think Eric likes me. And then the next show is like, no, I want Chris because he's good. And you completely changed the dialogue with me in terms of just like saying, now you understand what I want. Now I trust you to put in your sense.
Yeah, I don't mind being challenged. And sure. that's why, look, I want my... Soups artists, everyone's speaking up in daily. It's like, hey, that thing's too blue. It's like, I want to hear it.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you need someone that's driving the ship.
No, yeah. of course. And I really appreciated the fact because I learned, not only did I learn a lot on Tron, I think that like my sequence looks really good. And I thought I was very happy about the results in that. And I think that a lot to do because of the feedback that I got from you and Joe and everything else. But I remember like the next show, I was sort of saying, oh, hopefully it'll be, you know, Eric. And it's been a completely different dialogue. After since then, it's like, I only want to work with Eric. Eric's got really great stuff. And to be honest, that's not necessarily true because Eric Nash is also a really great guy. I love working yep. with Eric.
He's probably got a better sense of humor than I do.
No, you've got a very good sense of humor. Yours is a more of a nerdy humor, though. You throw out the nerd jokes more than he does.
That's good to know. My wife will appreciate that.
Yeah. But he's really great, but it's a very different style. But I learned very quickly, you know, that working on a show with you was all about like, this is a new standard. Like we have to, like everything else doesn't slide. When we were on Oblivion, nothing was sliding. We had to, perfection or nothing at that point, right?
Yeah, I mean, I always like to tell artists when they're struggling with something and they're not sure if it's finished, like, look, it only has to be perfect and then you can stop. Don't go any further. Because they just need to know that, you know, they're not going to put something out that's less than what they're capable of, right? Again, you got to kind of push them. And then sometimes when they do, then you look at, and what DD always had back in that time is, you know, world-class comp team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we could rely on that team to kind of help take it to that next little extra 5%.
Yeah. And I remember it was specifically we were looking at that project and Lisa, we've mentioned her before, who is just one of the greatest people in the world, especially
which
on the production.
Project?
Lisa, Oblivion.
Oh, Oblivion.
She basically came up, I forgot what the specific issues were, but she says, all right, let's get real on this project, on the bid. How small can you make your team? And I said, okay, so does it matter how senior they are? And I said, because if I can make it really small, if they're all really good guys that I know and trust and I've worked with before. And then you told me, says, okay, that's all good. But you're going to have to bring in some fresh blood at some point because you have to replenish that.
Absolutely.
So you made me go and interview a bunch of guys that were really, really junior. And I forgot the guy's name. He was awesome, though.
Oh, that's terrible.
Well, Art certainly, right?
Well, Art was great. Yeah. And Art's been doing a fantastic job. Yeah. But there's some really great guys that were just like, just trying to figure it out, you know, and they did really, really, really great work. Yeah. And I remember specifically you and I had a discussion about Art. We were like, you know, is he going to be able to do it? And I said, I trust him and I'm going to keep a very close eye. Don't worry, Eric.
Yep.
I got him. And we gave him one of the biggest shots in the movie.
Well, biggest shot in the movie. And, yeah. And you know, the one that at one point had gone away, then it kind of came back. And when it came back, you know, we had shown Joe, like 3 months before we showed him a single frame of the shot. We'd showed him the previs that he kind of signed off on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when him and I would talk privately, he says, so how's that shot coming? I'm like, oh, it's fine. It's fine. It's like, when can I see it? I'm like, yeah, not, you know, it'll be fine. And like literally once a week we'd have that same conversation. So how's that shot? It's like, it's great. It's going to be awesome. And you know, and that's why it was like, it has to be awesome.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when we finally did show it to him, he just looked over at me like, you're right.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing, right? Because obviously there's a lot of parts to make that. Art was the lighting part of it, right? And but he worked very, very closely with the modeling team and the texture team.
And the effects team, all of them.
They had one really, they did the same thing on all the teams. They had one really great modeler that was sort of leading that. Obviously, there were some other people who were contributing to it. One really great texture person that was doing anything that needed to be done for texture-wise. One fantastic effects guy. And then I think...
a great comper.
Who was Larson? What's his name? Kim, no, yeah, but he's anyway. He was fantastic, and it all just like, ta-da! Yeah. And it was all at that point. It was all about rendering because
it was a long render,
such a long shot, yeah. And it was all CG. So it was a lot of rendering. But it ended up being great. I mean, it's like a lot of those guys they just figured it out. They figured out. No, what
they did a great job.
Yeah,
like I said, when Joe saw it, he was very happy.
Yeah,
it still looks great.
Yeah, really happy with that. You were not. Were you on Oblivion?
No, I wasn't. Nope.
What were you working on? Oh, you were on Jack the Giant.
Jack the Studio Killer.
Yeah, that was another great one. Interesting one.
I'm so glad they used Beaver. I guess he didn't.
Well, actually, I got called back later to do one or two shots with it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you did him in. You did him in V-Ray.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to make sure it would get done.
It was originally they were going to be like mostly matte painting, and then they just had to get it done. So
right,
I had to take the assets that were all set up.
Yep,
for something else.
Yep. So there's a couple conversations. Like I said, I used to hang out in your office, and we'd have some very interesting creative conversations. We had one that I remember very specific. I think it was actually on Oblivion, and it was related to when you were worried about stuff getting done or like things not working right. And you gave me a great talk about craftsmanship. Do you remember that conversation? You've given it to several people.
I probably have. I only have a handful of things I say over and over again.
There's basketball analogies in there.
Crap, I got to rewrite my whole book.
With the craftsmanship you wanted to talk about was back at Art Center.
Yes.
And how about that? That was a first year class, right?
Yeah. It's called the a desk unit, essentially. It's right. Where they teach you how to use all the tools in the wood shop, mill,
table saw,
and then you got to come up with this piece of wood that has all the different things cut into it, and it has to be perfect. It has to be so sharp you'd almost cut yourself on it. Mm-hmm. But it teaches all the first your students how to work in the model shop and not chop their fingers off, and the level of craftsmanship that is expected out of the school from then on.
Right.
So yeah, so it's a very valuable experience. Going through it, then you get it. But if you haven't gone through it, it's hard to understand.
It was about it was a specific conversation about going over and over a thing till it was right. You know, you do it over and it's like, is that right? No, it's not right yet. And go over and over and over until it's right. And I remember that specific conversation. I said, you know, that's true. And there's definitely value to that.
Because you were trying to final a shot.
No. Well, yeah, I was trying to final a shot. It wasn't about that necessarily. But it was about like making something like what's the best methodology to get something to look correct, right? Yep. And you were talking about the craftsmanship. And I was like, that's very valid. But I remember in architecture school, I was taught something that's completely opposite to that, but still just as valid. In fact, you've done it yourself, was If it's not working, throw the damn thing away and try it some other way. And sometimes going over crafting it, like, you're just keep making the same mistakes over and over again.
Polishing is turd, right?
Yeah, then you just have to use a different tool.
This you have to working. Use a different tool. So that was something I realized, like, yeah, sometimes you just got to scrap it. Or, you know, sometimes, and you'd have, well, another thing is, like, if an artist is working on stuff, no matter how talented they are, if they're just stuck in a corner, they can't see past it, you got to give it to some other artist. Yep. And it's just, you know, I'm not doing it because you're not talented. I'm just giving you a break and give it someone else to try at it. And it doesn't mean that you failed. It just means that you're stuck and it sucks.
So, well, so, some soups are very sensitive and not wanting to hurt people's feelings or make people feel, you know, like they couldn't get the job done. And it's not that I'm not sensitive to that. It's just sometimes, you know, and it's probably because of my, I spent so many years in commercial. We, you know, the meter's running. We have to get stuff done. And sometimes you have to get someone else to do it.
Right.
Fresh eyes. Right.
Right, right, right. But okay, so let's go back to Art Center for a little bit, because that was an important part of the beginning of your career. How did you get to Art Center?
Oh, wow. So, you know, I was one of those kids that didn't have, you know, parents that had a plan for college or, you know, necessarily motivated me to go to college. It was just like, you know, you're going to graduate, then good luck to you kind of thing. So when I graduated from high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. Ironically, my older brother got a full ride to MIT and off he went.
Yep.
And I'm going, oh, okay. And, you know, my mom even said, well, Eric likes wine, women, and song more than he likes studying.
Right.
So having been through that experience and ended up at a junior college, which ironically, that's where I met my wife, who we've been married for 26 years. That all worked out great. But going through a junior college, besides, you know, getting to meet young, beautiful women, it was, this is not where I want to be. And what do I have to do to get out of here? And,
right.
You know, so first thing is I put my head down. It's like, all right, get my GE out of here, mm-hmm. get out of the way so I can figure out what I want to do with my college career. And I'd always been a kind of a car guy. So that led me to Art Center. College of Design in Pasadena, which, you know, at that point was the top design school in the world for,
yep.
for car design. And I was already going to Pasadena City College, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it's just up the hill. So I'm like, okay, well, that's where I want to go. And so from that point on, I just worked on my portfolio and getting my GE out of the way so I could actually get in. And then when you actually get into Art Center, then it's be careful for what you wish for,
right.
because it's so hard then to get out. And, you know, I had friends that went off to college and, you know, their weekends, they're out partying in bars and having all kinds of fun. And I pretty much spent every waking moment while I was at Art Center working.
Right.
And weekends, late nights, I got it. I don't know how I got in, because quite frankly, the class I was in, I didn't feel like I was as skilled as 90% of them. Mm-hmm. But so I had to work harder than everybody else just to keep my head above water, because they were so talented. I had all this talent around me. And that's where mm-hmm. I kind of learned by learning by osmosis. You have all this talent around you. It's natural that you're going to learn from them.
Yeah.
And I had some great guys in my class. And, you know, there was a lot of super talented people there at the time.
Yeah.
And my class is one of the last classes that had all the great instructors, the really old guys that they started to slowly retire. And some of them, you know, passed away. The guys that taught people like Sid Mead, mm-hmm. You know, Chip Foose was a couple years ahead of me at the time. Darren Guilford, who was a production designer,
right?
You know, he was there at the time. There was just a lot of.
Was Daniel Simon there too? Or?
He didn't go to Art Center.
Oh, okay.
He went to another school. But there was a lot. There was just an amazing amount of talent. So I got to learn from some amazing instructors,
yep.
and certainly some fellow artists that kind of taught me a hell of a lot too. You know, Craig Mullins was there at the time.
Yeah. I met him at Trojan Horse, actually.
Yeah,
he's a super nice guy.
Super nice guy. In fact, he, after third semester, I think they do this thing called Sketch Help, where a senior classman basically goes into one of the design studios and he just sits there with his stuff. And if you have problems or you need help with a sketch or a painting or something, mm-hmm. it's free time. And so I went in there one day and there's Craig Mullins doing this amazing illustration for, I think it was the Hilton Hotels or something. Mm-hmm. That he's probably getting paid $10,000 for. And I showed him my stuff, which, you know, it was pretty sheepish compared to what he was doing. Mm-hmm. He was super helpful, showed me what I was doing wrong, and yeah. off I went. But no, he was great. But there's a lot of people like that at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what got me to Art Center. But
you were into the car stuff then.
I was. So I went through and graduated from Art Center with a Bachelor of Science in Transportation Design, basically mm-hmm. a car designer. But at that time, you know, there weren't a lot of car design jobs.
Okay.
My wife, who I married when while I was at Art Center, was working at Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. And so when I graduated, I got flown out to Cleveland and to Kenner to design action toys for boys. Uh-huh. I got offered a job by Alias Wavefront to go to Dallas to be an applications engineer. And wow. Then there was a company in Hollywood who had just signed on to do reselling of Alias specifically to the entertainment industry. And that's the job I took because I went out to Cleveland.
So you were a reseller for Alias?
For about 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. Because what they'd give me is, here's your SGI and yeah. Here, I want you to go out on this job. And literally I was there for, I don't know, a few days. And they said, okay, so Steven Spielberg is setting up this new TV show called Sequest. There's a bunch of guys over there using video toasters. We want to send you over there. Show them what you can do with Alias and we'll sell a bunch of units and then we'll get you on the next job. I'm like, okay, great. And, you know, I'm fresh out of college. I don't know any better. Throw the SGI in my car, my little Miata at the time, and off I go. And I walk in, and one of the first guys I meet is this guy named Jim Lima, who mm-hmm. is an Art Center grad, mm-hmm. transportation design major, car designer, used mm-hmm. to work for General Motors, and got out of being a car designer, and now is an art director for Hollywood, and he's doing these amazing sketches for Sequest. And so we hit it off immediately.
Right.
So he'd give me a sketch, and I'd build it in Alias and go, ta-da, you know, and so then he was trusting me more and more, and that team was using, and Joe Conte was kind of running that team, was using Amigas and video toasters. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even understand what they were because I was used to, at that time, you know, SGI had this beautiful 24-bit monitor and, mm-hmm. you know, the graphics were amazing. And then you look at this Amiga and it's like flickering and it's like an 8.
Amiga was my first.
Yeah, it had like a 12-color interface. It's like, I couldn't even comprehend the fact that what do you mean it doesn't have 24-bit? I don't know. Yeah.
Right.
I don't understand.
Yep. But it cost a lot less.
It did cost a lot less. And so that's why I was there for 3 weeks. Because after a little bit, they made me an offer I couldn't say no to.
Yep.
And so I quit. And then at that point, the Sequest wasn't even fully picked up. We were in quote-unquote R&D mode. So mm-hmm. I quit my job and went on to something that could have just easily disappeared. But it was so much fun working, knowing that it's going to be on television. And they put an Amiga on my desk. They started teaching me Lightwave. And, of course, I had to take my SGI back to the company that I was at. And they're like, well, you know, Steven Spielberg has an SGI they gave him for Jurassic Park. Why don't you just go to his house? We've asked him. And just go pick it up and you can use it. I'm like, okay. So I hop in my car and with one of the little PAs and drive out to Steven's house. And mm-hmm. the security guy lets me in and takes us into his beautiful house and shows me where the SGI is. And I just...
Unplug it and rolled.
Let's go.
That was the SGI I used on my desk.
$75,000.
Yeah. Well, I think at that point it was an Indigo, so it's probably closer to 30. But I had that machine. I had a PC that to use FTP to transfer between the two, and then I had two Amigas on my desk.
You had a PC to transfer stuff.
Yeah, because I was also using Electric Image.
Oh,
right.
I don't even remember. I was using a DFX.
Electric Image was made by Softimage, wasn't it?
I was using a DFX translator. It's been a while.
Yeah.
So I had four machines on my desk because, you know, when you hit render on one of those video toasters, you go, okay, now what do I do? And so we just switch over to the
get
next
on the internet.
One.
Oh, wait.
Yeah. That was
pre-internet.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. What do you do? So I had the three machines, so I could just pop it back and forth. And anyway, that's how I transitioned from being a car designer to this business.
Yeah, well, that's cool. And
I did not know all that. That's awesome, actually. What's your brother doing now? I want to know.
Is he at NASA from MIT?
He doesn't have an Academy Award, that's for sure.
No, his field, they don't give those out. But he's doing great with the company he's at. It just worked out that way.
Yeah. That's really cool.
It's inspiring.
It is inspiring. So since I want to make sure that we cover a little bit of the fact that you're how long were you at DD for? 20 years?
Just under 20 years.
Just under 20 years. But you've since left and you're about to go on some new endeavors, which is why we had an emergency podcast date. Make sure we had it. So tell people what's going on, if you can. What have you done since then, or where are you going now?
Well, post DD, you know, I had some great opportunities with some great projects with mm-hmm. the studios. I immediately got involved with Studio 8 and Ang Lee on potentially his next film. And Joe had a, you know, we're friends, obviously. He had a bunch of spots he wanted me to do. And because of that aforementioned relationship with Tim and Reset and Dave Morrison, and they're all, you know, we decided to do those spots over at Blur.
Yeah.
And,
which was kind of fun because, you know, we're right around, we do a lot of stuff with Blur. We're great friends. I think Betty knows me and I just walk in now. Yeah. So
they're so nice. And there's a great, talented team there. And they're certainly their own little, you know, way of working. And, you know, both Tim and Jennifer Miller, they're the nicest people.
Yeah.
So, you know, we parked some of these spots because I do jumping back and forth between, you know, spot work and films. And, I had a plethora of movies that didn't get greenlit, so it's been you know, I don't mind doing commercials.
Sure.
And helping other film directors trying to get their projects going. Yeah. So.
And Joe needs your help. You're not going to. It's hard to say no.
No, well, he's a friend. Sure. Yeah, exactly. Of course, I'm going to help him out. Yep. You know, we absolutely.
And Tim was kind of busy on Deadpool.
Tim was kind of busy. Well, I met Tim at the Oblivion premiere.
Oh, yeah.
It was actually David Morrison that introduced us.
Okay, great.
And so, you know, it was really that relationship. So when I found out, you know, Dee wasn't going to bid Deadpool, I'm like, that can't be the case. Let me go meet with Tim. And Tim and I had lunch, and, you know, and then we got the bid package. And, you know, we helped bring that project in. Tim's great. I'm so happy for him and the success of Deadpool. And
I couldn't be happier. Yeah.
It's awesome. He's such a nice guy, and, you know, it's nice to see a nice guy, you know, have good success.
I did. You've heard the podcast I did with him, and he is such a humbling person.
He's great.
Which is funny because I don't think he used to be.
He
didn't used to be at all. And he's actually, even on the podcast, admitted it himself. It was like, I learned a lot over the years about, you know, I used to be a real macho guy and had all this stuff, and I've learned a lot. And he says that openly, and he's not, and it's great. You know, I emailed him after Deadpool came out, and I was like, this is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I'm so happy for his success. And he emailed me back within a day. He said, yeah, thanks a lot. It was really great to do it, and I really appreciate your support on it. And so,
no, he's I'm so happy for their success, and, you know, obviously I look forward to what they do next.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But can you tell people? I mean, obviously it's out on the news.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So no,
it's on Hollywood Reporter, so he can affect you.
I am off to Vancouver. I'll be working for Industrial Light and Magic.
Nice.
I've taken the position of creative director and visual effects supervisor.
So what does that mean as a creative director? Because there's a lot of different definitions of creative director.
Well, every company uses that term a little differently. Mm-hmm. So in at ILM, they have a creative director at each one of their facilities, one in London, one in Singapore, certainly, you know, John Nolan in San Francisco, and then I'll have that role in Vancouver.
Okay.
And essentially we're the responsible for the creative that comes out of those facilities.
Okay.
And we'll be responsible for our own projects as well. So
you will also be supervising as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yes. I don't see you not supervising.
No. I certainly want to. I need to go out and make another movie because it's just been a little while. You know, like I said, I was on set.
Yeah,
six movies that didn't get greenlit that I was attached to. Mm-hmm. You know, starting with Fincher's 20,000 Leagues that, you know, I desperately wanted to do.
A couple of tests on that. Too.
Yeah, and then, you know, the first iteration of Tron, and then I spent 6 months with Gary Ross on Peter and the Starcatcher, which was going to be great, and then, you know, Disney decided not to make that film, and, you know, I ended up helping out a little bit. Obviously, we did Gone Girl with David last, and then I got attached to Sinister Six at Sony.
Oh, right, okay.
Which Drew Goddard, and I would love to work with Drew. He just had such great ideas, and then, of course, for some reason, North Korea hacked Sony, and the rest is history. And then that's when I got involved with Beauty and the Beast, right?
Right.
Because Steve Gobb was the visual effects producer on that film, and Jeff Silver was the line producer, who I worked with both of them on Tron.
Yep,
I remember. So they approached me about doing that project. Would you be interested in? And at that point, Dee Dee hadn't been contacted for that project. And so I got us involved, and then I got Steve Gobb to come and see the test we had done. And they wanted me to do it, but Tron was, you know, Sinister Six was going down, Tron was coming up. And of course, Joe and I have been talking about doing Tron 3 for quite a while. So
yeah.
We got someone else to kind of get on to Beast.
And Tron 3 almost happened. It was really close.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's cross our fingers and, you know, hopefully it'll come back again. And then last fall, there's a couple of movies I was looking at, and I kind of hit it off with Rupert Wyatt, who was doing Gambit at mm-hmm. Fox.
Oh, right.
And that looked like it was going to go. And then, you know, there's probably some, you know, script issues or some, you know, money issues. But anyway, Rupert decided to not do that project. And so
right.
that kind of went away. And
well, that's cool. Well, that's cool. And you were telling us, I mean, one of the contacts that you had, or some of the person that really was instrumental in your relationship with ILM is Kathleen Kennedy. Is that right?
Yeah, certainly. You know, she's been fantastic. I got to work with Kathy on Benjamin Button,
right?
And David, and you know, they're friends, and you know, she's, I mean, who wouldn't want to work with her and that team up there? And so
okay.
I've kind of always wanted to work for ILM kind of secretly, you know, I always felt like, you know, being in Digital Domain in Venice was kind of, we're the poor kids from down south.
The garage yeah. band of
yeah,
Visual Effects.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be
but that's
nice?
Kind of cool too.
That's
though.
Why I went down there. Yeah. I was leaving Lucasfilm.
But it is kind of cool to be like the garage band.
It's good to see both sides of the fence, I guess.
Yeah. But you know, at the same time, like I don't want to make the cheapest visual effects. I just want to make the best visual effects.
Sure.
And so
yeah.
it's nice.
Back to the craftsmanship, right?
Yeah. When you have the tools to do
yep. the resources.
Really great work. So for me, it's always kind of been there. And so, you know, I'm very happy that we've been able to make that happen.
Yeah. And you're according to the article, you'll probably be doing a little bit of stuff with ILMX Lab, is that right? Or
they have an amazing lab there that I got to see, and they're doing some really great stuff. So more to come.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all great. Well, I mean, I was blown away with some of the stuff they've shown me, quite frankly. It's impressive. And, you know, it makes me a little sad because of, you know, being at the place I was for the last almost 20 years. And then to see, you know, how other companies are doing what they're doing and what they can kind of reach out and grab. It's
right.
It's
well, let us know. And if there's stuff that you can think of that labs could be, that my labs, Chaos Group Labs, could be involved with, because that's the kind of stuff that I want to make sure, like, hey, you know, we'll help anyone out at all kinds of stuff. Kevin Margo over at Blur, we helped out on Construct. And I don't know if I've showed you the thing that we did. It's a quick video. I can show you how we did that. But it's cool that you've done that stuff. And, you know, at the same time, you've got involved with Joe. You know, Joe and David, they're forward-thinking technology guys as well.
Absolutely.
They really think of things. So if there's stuff that those guys want to think about, let me know as well. Because, I mean, I've known Joe as well. He's an ex-architect, so he and I talk about that every now and then when we do that stuff. So it's really cool. So when are you moving? Not too long, right?
No, I mean, my plan is to be up there April 1st in Vancouver. I'll start.
So like 3 weeks.
Yeah, I'll start.
Do you have a place to live up there? Or
thankfully, my wife was all over that, and she secured us in a nice place and a really great tower in Vancouver.
Awesome.
Yeah, she's it's a lot of...
She's ready to go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. She's giddy. She's...
Well, are the kids out of the house?
The kids are out of the house now. Oh, your daughter's with you.
My daughter's with us. My 21-year-old daughter, who graduated from college last May, she's going to be moving with us.
But, okay.
Well, she's awesome. My son's still in college down here, so, you know.
What's he studying?
Right now, he's in a film project.
Of course he is. Well, he was in that. He was.
I don't know how he got into that.
Yeah. But he was doing acting as well, right?
And ironically, it was when we did the Halo 3 spot with Joe, my son was 9 years old, and he'd been bugging me to take him on set. And I took him to the shoot, and they had cast a 9-year-old boy to play and he just laid down in the field and had some lines. And my son's all, I could do that. Yeah. And then he was bugging mom to get him into that. And
I can't believe how long ago that was. Now that you said he was 9, I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, he's 18.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we were on Tron and he would show up every now and then.
Yeah.
And he was a teenage kid, right? Yeah. He was like 12, something like that, 13.
Well, back then, he probably 13.
Yeah. And so he would look at it. I remember we were looking at... I forgot what it was. He was sitting next to you and we're looking at a shot. Oh, I remember the shot. It was when the recognizer lands, like... Yep. Comes down right by the jail, not the one in the city, but when it goes to the jail or whatever, and he goes, that's cool. Like, there's a, just his voice in the, and you said, that was the reaction I was looking for. Good. We know we've succeeded.
Finally. Absolutely. He's, you know, he's been excited about the work. I got to take him on to the Tron sets in Vancouver.
Yep.
And so,
and when we were working on the other Halo spot, when Master Chief is coming out of hibernation, and your son was looking at it, he was explaining to you the history behind Halo. It's like, no, you don't understand. Yeah. He's like going through the whole history of like, Cortana does this, and da da da. And he was explaining everything to you. And you're like, oh, okay, all right. He's like, make sure you get this right.
Yeah. It's been fun having him around, seeing the stuff that Dad's up to.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, all right. We are perfectly at about 1:05, so I am going to you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep the last bucket.
Okay, hang on.
Because I kept joking about the sign off on the podcast. It's like we don't really use buckets anymore because buckets are kind of going away.
I still use them.
Yeah,
I'm old school.
But we're using
a bucket
more
to wash my car. Yeah,
exactly. Progressive rendering. But here's the thing: it's like, because it's old school, right? So that's kind of retro to say the last bucket. On top of that, it's in the intro song, so I don't want to change the song. So I'm going to keep with bucket.
All right, or we could go further back and just say when the last scan line finishes.
Really? No, I'm not going
to
do that.
I wanted to ask Eric about VR.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Just because it's like non-film related, but maybe not.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Like we have to deal with lots of industries now, and VR is, you know, obviously one of them, and you know how we fit in there is in many sort of different ways, and people are trying to figure out whether or not storytelling is possible in that space, and it's definitely a very polarized subject, and I know that. Or at least I think I know that there was, when you were at DD, that there was a lot of sort of preliminary R&D on, you know, for VR related stuff. And I don't know if that was all Gary's group or not, but I thought I had heard that your name, like you were helping out with that.
I've been focused on the, you know, feature film and commercial world. I tried to stay away from the VR stuff only because I don't really understand it just yet.
Okay. That's what I was looking for. Like, what's your take on it? Like, what do you think is...
I think the AR for me is more compelling than VR.
So do I.
And I think if you can... And I would just use this simple analogy. It's like, look, one of the things I've seen is, you know, certainly the gondola ride in Venice. It's like, to me, that's a good use of VR because you're taking someone who might be somewhere else, maybe never be able to get to Venice, Italy, and you can show them something. Yep. But that's the most rudimentary version, certainly for games. It'll be great. Storytelling, I haven't personally seen anything that's compelling.
Right.
I don't think we figured it out.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we will, but we...
No, someone will figure it out. I'm just saying up till now, I haven't seen anything that's gotten me excited about it enough to want to put those goggles on for more than 30 seconds.
Right.
And AR, I think, is much more compelling for many different reasons. And I have seen some things that... went, oh, that's kind of cool.
More useful.
More useful and
inside a car.
Well, just everywhere, right? There's so many things you can instantly do with just devices. You don't have to necessarily have goggles.
Right.
Because the idea of high frame rate and stereo and all that kind of thing is you know, it's not useful for everything.
Right.
Whereas
it is useful for something. I mean, to be honest, I think architecture is like immediately useful.
Yes.
Right.
Well, games and architecture, sure. Anything you need to virtual set. Walkthroughs,
yep.
Right? Those could be super useful. I mean, I can think of reasons, but is there anything compelling where that's what I want to go do? Not yet.
Right.
Not yet. I still enjoy making movies and you know.
I don't think VR is not going to replace movies at all, ever. Because I think that's a different art form in the same way that movies didn't kill books, right?
Yeah. Sure.
I find myself doing like sanity checks though because I'm not having buy-in, you know? Like I appreciate it for what it is, and I definitely know it's overhyped, but I'm always asking like guys like you or people that I know just to make sure that because there are times that I'm like,
am I missing something?
Maybe I should be working at a VR company. I mean, am I missing something? Like, what's going on? Like, I don't.
Well, look, someone is probably going to come out with some technology that makes us go, oh, I get it now. And it's amazing.
And you're going to be
how dumb am I?
You know what? I'll take that. I think the technology is actually the thing, but the problem is the content. Someone's going to have to come up with some content that shows why you need that.
I haven't seen a good spot. What I've seen is a lot of people spend a lot of money and time, and you look and go, eh, you know, it's just not compelling.
Yeah.
At least that's my take on it.
I mean, I see the use, like, okay, this is technology that's going to evolve. And
there's a long game to it, and it's like
there's a long game.
And you got to get the hardware out of the way. Yeah. And then maybe.
Yeah, and the hardware's not quite there, right? Because you can still see the pixels, and it's just not the fastest enough refresh. And
it'll get better, and it'll get better.
Yeah, maybe next gen, you know.
But we've only just gotten used to not seeing pixels. You know what I mean?
True, but it's amazing how quickly you're like, oh, yeah. Then when you see one, like, what the hell is that thing? I can see a screen. It's not really a screen. It's the pixel.
And yep.
Yeah, so that's why I was disappointed with the latest, you know, versions of the hardware.
Right.
They still haven't got to high enough resolution where it's total buy-in.
Yep.
Maybe if my eyes get softer as I get older, it'll make naturally blend everything together.
Yeah. But I think there's some good use cases for it. Definitely different industries will take it differently. And I think the answer to how does it relate to storytelling, that's actually a question that we've been asking a lot. I don't think
it's
there
not that important. I mean, it's just, no, it seems it like, no, well, I mean, it is, it's not the linchpin.
Well, it's not important yet until someone shows you something where you go, holy crap.
Right.
But it's a medium, right? And if like,
oh, yeah.
If it can't serve, you know, like computer graphics serves lots of, you know, industries and lots of purposes, whether it's medical imaging or
car
whatever.
Design
or, you know, exactly, like the design process or marketing or, you know, what's in
commercials or movies.
Film
any
or,
type of virtual walkthrough.
Right.
You could see, you know, even like you said, the car thing, it's like virtual showroom. You walk in, you can sit in the car, you could actually see what the thing's going to look like versus having to get down to your local dealer.
Yep.
Those types of things are I could totally see happening.
Yeah.
So that becomes
you
more
shopping Amazon that way, right? Like it's not going to be going through a switch
you can
box.
See
you're
stuff
be in, walking down aisles.
Yeah, you could actually see stuff with, you know, correct scale and perspective in different lighting, and you can control the lighting versus again having to leave. So those things make sense for me for VR. The storytelling part, like you said, I just haven't seen it yet.
Yep. Do you have any other questions you want to ask?
No, that's it.
Sure.
Yes. Do you still do you? Well,
go ahead.
Do you own a Tesla yet, Eric?
Ironically, I literally watched my Tesla drive off on Monday.
Wait. Oh, you shipped it? Or no, you sold it?
I had to get rid of it.
Why?
Because I didn't know that you had one, by the way. Our bet earlier was like, I wonder if he's still driving this, you know, this other car. And I was like, nah, I bet you he's got a Tesla.
Well, you're right. up until Monday, you cannot import a U.S. model Tesla into Canada.
Well, it certainly isn't because of emissions.
it's literally on the Canadian website. There's something, and Tesla Canada has said they don't have the resources to modify whatever they need to modify to meet Canadian regulations. So they won't allow you to basically.
So are you going to buy a Tesla in Canada?
Well, I think I mentioned to you earlier, I'm with like in
walking
10 minutes of bike distance, and you know I'm a cyclist. So you guys,
are you still biking?
I am, but. I'm looking forward to maybe walking to work.
Yeah, I've been riding my bike here.
Yeah, it's like...
You know, it gets cold in Canada, right?
No, it does. And it rains a lot, apparently, too. Yeah. No, I loved the Tesla. I mean, I can't tell you how much I love that car.
How long did you own it?
Almost a year. I got it in April of last year. And I don't want to talk too much about Tesla, but it just changes your perception of vehicles. I'm a car guy. I can't help myself with cars, right?
Yep.
I still have the 911. It just changes, like, if you drive that thing and you go, every other car is 50-year-old technology.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
And it was actually more fun to drive than my 911, dare I say. And and so I just, the 911 just sat in the garage.
Wow.
And in traffic and stuff, it's much easier. I'm not polluting the earth because I'm a cyclist. There's a couple of times when I was in PV and the cars would go by me and I'd start coughing, like, oh, my God, it smells. And I'm like, is that me? Am I out there driving around polluting everything?
Right.
That's why I said I need an electric car.
Yeah.
So I loved it, but Canada wouldn't let me bring it. So
man, I did not know that. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's,
I guess it's just like certain regulations, not necessarily emissions, obviously, but like safety features or.
You know, I didn't look at it that much because my wife is really great about making a list of all these are things that we have to do, and we're trying to figure out how do I get the car up there, and that was the roadblock. They won't let me bring it in, so I was like, well. I'm not going to leave it in the garage here. Right. It's far too expensive to just, so I had to get rid of it. But yeah, maybe I'll get another one up there.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll get the X.
All right. I'm actually thinking about putting a bit down on the E, the Tesla. Is it E?
Oh,
no,
three. Yeah.
Because it's the cheap one, right?
Well,
for the people.
It's the economic. Yeah. It's for the masses. Yeah. Plus, you can put money down now and get it in 3 years or something.
No, 1 year. Okay. Supposedly. Ideally, it's $1,000 down, and then you can get it in 2017.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I can wait that long. I don't know. I'll have to see.
It'll fly by.
I don't know. I'm a huge fan of Tesla and of I'm actually
you get
huge
a man
fan
crush
of,
on
I've totally got a man crush on Elon Musk. I am just totally enamored by his way of thinking. I think he's a really innovative thinker.
Totally.
I like how he spends his money. It's not necessarily to make more money. It's on things that interest him. Yeah. And a lot of the things that are geared towards making things better for everybody.
He also makes – like, you know, you bought that Tesla, right? You didn't – you. It's not like you felt guilty into buying it. You felt like, that's a really cool car. I'm going to get it. Oh, by the way, I'm also going to happen to help the environment at the same time, right? He makes fun things like you want to get that because it's cool.
Well, I Franz von Holzhausen, who designed the Tesla, I went to school with.
Right. So he was in the book. Yes. Yeah,
so from a design perspective, you know, I think Franz did a great job. It's a beautiful car.
Yeah.
So it hit all my buttons. It looks great.
Yeah.
You drive the thing, you go, holy crap.
It's ridiculous off the line.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And then you go, and I'm not polluting the planet.
Right.
Sure, it's expensive. You know, I'm not the kind of person that looks at things as status symbols, at least cars, because I'm just a car guy. I can't help myself.
Yeah.
So it's like, it just hit all the right buttons. And plus, I can drive the Diamond Lane trying to get to and from the studios sometimes. Yeah. It's hard in traffic on the 405.
Yeah.
So it just made sense. And my wife's all, go for it. And she says go for it.
Your wife says, yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Awesome. Well, that's definitely the big green light there.
And it was made in the U.S., which, you know.
Yep.
Nothing is made in the U.S. Yeah.
Yeah. So at the awesome. At the old NUMMI factory, which, by the way, is a fascinating story. There's an incredible This American Life story about that factory, how it started off as a GM factory and how it was really, really messed up with in terms of efficiency, and that they pretty much let go of everyone and hired and then trained people to work with Toyota, and that's how the GM Toyota relationship happened.
The Toyota way.
Yeah, and they made Corollas there for a long, 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 long time, and then that eventually they sold it, and it just like became the Tesla factory. But I love the story of that factory. One day I want to go visit it sometime. Again, it's probably because my Elon Musk fetish. All right, guys. Well, thanks. I'm going to let the last bucket drop, and we're going to sign off. And thanks, Eric. And when you come back to LA, just let me know, and we can grab some lunch or something.
Sure, we'll do.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye.